profit motive will not produce privacy, let alone will it produce robust defense for freedom in the street. The right net brings freedom and the wrong net brings tyranny because it all depends on how the code works. I know how eager you are to deal with technical matters, and I'm sorry to start with politics first thing in the morning, but it's urgent. You've been watching it all around the world the past several weeks, haven't you? It's about how politics actually works now for people actually seeking freedom now, for people trying to make change in their world now. Software is what the 21st century is made of. What steel was to the economy of the 20th century, what steel was to the power of the 20th century, what steel was to the politics of the 20th century, software is now. It's the crucial building block, the component out of which everything else is made. And when I speak of everything else, I mean, of course, freedom, as well as tyranny, as well as business as usual, as well as spying on everybody for free all the time. In other words, the very composition of social life, the way it works or doesn't work for us, the way it works or doesn't work for those who own, the way it works or doesn't work for those who oppress, all now depends on software. What has happened in Iran, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and what will happen in other societies over the next few years demonstrates the enormous political and social importance of social networking. But everything we know about technology tells us that the current forms of social network communication, despite their enormous current value for politics, are also intensely dangerous to use. They are too centralized. They are too vulnerable to state retaliation and control. And the design of their technology, like the design of almost all unfree software technology, is motivated more by business interests seeking profit than by technological interests seeking freedom. As a result of which, we are watching political movements of enormous value, capable of transforming the lives of hundreds of millions of people, resting on a fragile basis, like, for example, the courage of Mr. Zuckerberg, or the willingness of Google to resist the state, where the state is a powerful business partner and a party Google cannot afford to insult.
Do you have a Facebook? Have you thought about the privacy you put at risk? The Facebook allows users to post their favorite music, books, movies, their address, hometown, phone number, email, clubs, jobs, educational history, birth dates, sexual orientation, interests, daily schedules, exactly how they are related to friends, upload pictures of themselves, and even political affiliations. Its privacy policy even goes so far as to state it also collects information about you from other sources, such as newspapers and instant messaging services. This information is gathered regardless of your use of the website. Think that's scary? The Facebook's term of service states, by posting member content to any part of the website, you automatically grant, and you represent and warrant that you have the right to grant, to Facebook an irrevocable, perpetual, non-exclusive, transferable, fully paid, worldwide license with the right to sublicense to use, copy, perform, display, reformat, translate, excerpt in whole or in part, and distribute such information and content, and to prepare derivative works of, or incorporate into other works, such information and content, and to grant and authorize sublicenses of the foregoing.
The struggle for freedom of thought, which is universally admired, though not always actually supported, goes along with a much less universally admired struggle for economic justice and the equality of persons. Die Gedanken sind frei. What's its contemporary little phrase or verse? Well, I would nominate one. When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? The phrase attributed to John Ball, the leader of the peasants' revolt in England in 1381. We have associated the struggle for human equality with the struggle for freedom of knowledge, and we have associated them rightly. They belong together. Because the recognition of individual possibility to allow each to be what she and he can be rests inherently upon the availability of knowledge. The perpetuation of ignorance is the beginning of slavery. So we are part, then, of two struggles, whether we like it or not. A struggle for the freedom of thought and a struggle for justice to persons. That the ownership of culture, the commoditization of learning, poses a danger to a movement for equality and economic justice is obvious to all. This is, as Thomas Gregor just pointed out, I think very eloquently, an inherent part of the problem of globalization, whose sunny side we are. For globalization otherwise means the impoverishment of workers through remorseless competition between the rich and poor parts of humanity. A struggle conducted for the benefit of the shareholders, that is, the few, through limitations of knowledge available to the many. Accordingly, we meet the 21st century not as the inventors of something new, but as the latest generation struggling for ideals that are very old. We are living in a world in which real-time information crucial to people in the street seeking to build their freedom depends on a commercial microblogging service in Northern California, which must turn a profit in order to justify its existence to the people who design its technology, and which we know is capable of deciding overnight all by itself to donate the entire history of everything everybody said through it to the Library of Congress. Which means, I suppose, that in some other place they could make a different style of donation. We need to fix this. We need to fix it quickly. We are now behind the curve of the movements for freedom that depend on code. And every day that we don't fix the problems created by overcapitalized social network media to do the politics of freedom, the real politics of freedom, in the street where the tanks are, the more we don't fix this, the more we are becoming part of the system which will bring about a tragedy soon.
I don't know how. Be more good than bad, or we'd already be gone.
I went down into the New York City subway one day, and I found a man down there who plays the violin for money in the subway at his usual place. And in the back of his violin case, where he collected the dimes and the quarters, he had put a photograph of Václav Havel. And underneath he had written, "Artists will rule." That's us. And he's right. It's a struggle. It has winners and losers. It is a velvet revolution. It is the fulfillment of long hopes and the deepest of dreams, and we are fortunate to carry it to fruition this time. The network makes it possible for us. What we have done is what we build on, but we have to keep it safe. We require four things: free software, free hardware, free culture, and free spectrum. I mean by those four things to set before you the pillars of the revolution we have already made, as well as those things that we must build further on. Free software, it needs hardly any definition. It means to create technology which everyone can change, everyone can improve, and everyone can share. We've done it. Free hardware is essentially a conservative cry. It means keep the military occupation out of the net. Keep the hardware from obeying Mr. Eisner rather than the person who bought it. Make sure that hardware responds to the people to whom it belongs, not to the people who send bit streams through it. The war for free hardware will be sharp, short, and inevitably successful, but we have to fight it. There are forces in our societies which believe that only if every single electronic device is under their control is their business model safe. They're correct. Left to their own devices, they would recast the network in that mold to protect their businesses. But they're not going to be left to their own devices. We have the devices, and they belong to us. So our goal is to conserve that property of the network, that it is made of things that we have bought, we have installed, we possess, and that respond to our demands, not the demands of some third party who has got a movie temporarily moving through them. We will win that fight, and we will have little to show for it beyond what we already have. Nonetheless, we have to do it.
Have you seen the Facebook's Pulse feature? Pulse provides statistical trends among universities down to minute details such as percentages of females with conservative views, the student body's top 10 movies, and percentage of students who have read Catcher in the Rye. The so-called privacy policy goes on to say that they may share your information with third parties, including responsible companies with which they have a relationship. Can you think of any marketing group who would pass up buying such valid yet easily collected statistics such as these and others? So maybe they're using us. But is there more? The first venture capital money totaled at $500,000 came to the Facebook from venture capitalist Peter Thiel, founder and former CEO of PayPal. He also serves on the board of radical conservative group Vanguard PAC. Further funding came in the form of $12.7 million from venture capital firm Accel Partners. Accel's manager, James Breyer, was former chair of the National Venture Capital Association. Breyer served on National Venture Capital Association's board with Gilman Louie, CEO of InQtel, a venture capital firm established by the Central Intelligence Agency in 1999. This firm works in various aspects of information technology and intelligence, including most notably, nurturing data mining technologies.
The network society, which has restored our sense of primary contact, unintermediated, not through Mr. Murdoch, not by way of Mr. Gates, but directly with one another, by chat, by email, by video exchange, by file sharing, we are connected to ourselves. That network society recapitulates contentions among classes, communities, and groups, traditional in all societies. But it recapitulates those contentions in a new form. Precisely because we are allowed to share. We are not struggling for primacy in the market. We are not struggling over which class will possess the means of production. We know where the means of production are. They're inside our own heads. We are struggling to come into ourselves. We need not take anything away from anybody else. There will be losers. The losers are those who have proposed to own what we have made. But we are not required to do more than to exist as creators and to share our works.
Copying is not theft. Stealing a thing leaves one less left. Copying it makes one thing more. That's what copying's for. Copying is not theft. If I copy yours, you have it too. One for me and one for you. That's what copies can do. If I steal your bicycle, you have to take the bus. But if I just copy it, there's one for each of us. Making more of a thing. That is what we call copying. Sharing ideas with everyone. That's why copying is fun.
Wikipedia and WikiLeaks are two sides of the same coin. They are the two sides of the same coin, the third side of which is FOSDEM. It is the power of ordinary people to organize to change the world without having to create hierarchy and without having to recapitulate the structures of power that are being challenged by the desire to make freedom. WikiLeaks was being treated everywhere around the world in a semi-criminal fashion at Christmas time. And then events in Tunisia made it a little more complicated. As it became clear that what was being reported on around the world as though it were primarily a conspiracy to injure the dignity of the U.S. State Department, or to embarrass the United States military, was actually really an attempt to allow people to learn about their world, to learn about how power really operates, and therefore to do something about it. And what happened in Tunisia was, I thought, an eloquent rebuttal to the idea that the WikiLeaks end of free culture and free software was primarily engaged in destruction, nihilism, or I shrink from even employing the word in this context, terrorism. It was instead freedom, which is messy, complicated, potentially damaging in the short term, but salvational in the long term, the medicine for the human soul. Culture. To my dear colleague, Professor Lessig, who has trademarked the phrase, I owe an analysis so deep and so comprehensive that there is little left to say. We must have the ability to make our various arts collaboratively out of what we have already done by adding imagination untaxed to what already is. This is a promise for an acceleration of education throughout the globe. Billions of minds hungering for knowledge and for beauty, to whom everything can now be given. In a world where everything is a bitstream, where the marginal cost of culture is zero, where once one person has something, everything can be given to everybody at the same cost that it was given to its first possessor, it is immoral to exclude people from knowledge and from beauty. That is the great moral problem that the 20th century has bequeathed to the 21st. We can eradicate ignorance at the expense of a few. We have to do it. We cannot permit the voluntary starvation of most of the minds on the planet. We have a duty. We have a joy. We are bringing to our colleagues, the human race, everything we know and everything we love. There is no higher pleasure than delivering what we love to those with whom we wish to share it. There is also no deeper moral obligation. Free hardware and free software are two-thirds of the platform for free culture. But without bandwidth, boxes sit dumb. We must recapture for everyone the common property of the electromagnetic spectrum. Every legal system at its bottom agrees that the spectrum is common, that it belongs to all. And every legal system denies as practical reality what it proposes as principle. Every system continues to maintain that government must control how spectrum is used. Sometimes, quite explicitly, for the purpose of remaining itself in power. Sometimes, in a claim of some civilizing mission, on the belief that government and only government can really artfully determine who ought to speak to the masses in the interest of the expansion of knowledge. And sometimes, as in my society, out of sheer venality, we, the politicians, have taken bribes from you, the media owners, and we will faithfully reflect the interests of our masters who have put us in. But whatever the reason may be, whether venality or lust for power or a misguided belief in the superiority of government wisdom about who should speak to many, spectrum allocation is an evil whose time has come. This is far more complicated than the problems that we have solved in freeing software, more complicated than the problem that we face in keeping hardware free, far more complicated than the problem of inducing 12-year-olds to share music and help free culture. But it is not beyond our power on the basis of what we already have. We need dream no utopian dreams to achieve bandwidth for all on equal terms. We possess already working code and proof of concept. It is called Wi-Fi. It is the attempt to use a small, not particularly desirable piece of spectrum to model the possibility of self-organized, non-hierarchical, decentralized, equal measure access to electromagnetic spectrum. And we are showing what the alternative actually is. Those of us here who work on this issue are able to show to populations all around the globe the telephone bill-less future. The place where nobody pays to talk to anybody else by the sip, by the minute, by the tick, by the impulse anymore. We can build that thick mesh that embraces all of us and add at communal expense the long-haul communications portions which tie that mesh together, and we can offer people equality of communication. Mr. Murdoch will be disappointed. Deutsche Telekom will be heartbroken. Tough. Edison made it possible for music, which had been for the whole history of human beings an act of communion, a thing inherently shared. That music turned into a product, an object, a commodity. And from the commoditization of art grew the belief that art could be owned, which made sense. Even when art was bumps on a thin piece of tinfoil in a plastic disc. But art has returned to the formlessness from which it came. It has returned to being what it was throughout the history of human beings until Edison. It has returned to being something that must be shared to exist. The technology of the late 20th century reversed the conditions of power that made it. This is not the first time that that system of social production called capitalism has had that effect. When I wrote a little thing called the Dot Communist Manifesto some while ago, I was doing it in order to show that a form of social analysis characteristic of those searching for freedom in the 19th century might bear some recognition in the 21st. Not as a matter of normative political analysis, but as a comment on the actualities of the day. The struggle of bourgeois technology towards ever greater functioning, such that it undermines its own conditions of existence, was an observation made by shrewd onlookers 140 years ago. And we live in the fulfillment of its truth. Ownership struggled to reduce its costs, to hold down the costs of making the commodity in order to free itself to greater profit. And in the end, as was so shrewdly noted in the 1860s, all that was solid melted into air, and air was something that we all knew we could freely breathe. And so we found ourselves confronting a system of power based upon ideas of property relations that the technology of the owners was already making obsolete. It is not possible for industrial organizations to do a better job of distributing music than 12-year-olds can do. Hence, the world in which the music industry confronts the children on the barricades, attempts to jail them, fine them, control them, and loses. The same is true for all the other forms of art given to us by the 20th century and being freed by the very technology that the controllers of artists hoped would control art even further. This, like the adoption of movable type printing at the end of the 15th century, constitutes a moment at which the powers of control have adopted technology which transforms their conditions of existence, will they, nil they. They do not will it, but it happens to them anyway. And the technology that they have freed, like the sorcerer's apprentice, finds itself overwhelmed by its own implications.
Life is to come. Move away from your western lands, travel towards eastern suns. Far above all earthly goals, a pledge for creation's soul. Spirit finds fresh morning in the dew of precious things. Hope is a phoenix bearing wings to fly. Shall be like a breath of fresh air, safe and secret power that no lurking snare. Move away from your western guns, travel towards eastern suns, far above earthly goals, a pledge for creation's soul.
The free software movement, with which I have had some slight association, the free software movement is the beginning of the recognition of the implications of the technology. A recognition based not on the idea I could write better software if I could share it with other people, but rather, as Mr. Stallman made clear from the beginning, a political recognition. Freedom is a good in itself. Inhibiting sharing, prohibiting people from teaching what they know to others and from learning what they want to know themselves is wrong. The free software movement was not a technology movement. It was a phase of the struggle for freedom of thought in technological guise. It took advantage of technological reality to bring about a deeper scrutiny of political possibility. And we are here today because those political possibilities have sunk in. There is not a government on earth any longer which fails to comprehend the social possibilities of the freedom of software as a development strategy for an economy, as an education strategy for a population, as a reassertion of the public's right to get what it pays for in the public servants whom it employs to think and devise and to improve the infrastructure of social life. There is not an enterprise on earth in the technology industries which fails to recognize the enormous constructive power of unleashed creativity in individual people. This very week, an organization, Sun Microsystems, which has shown in the past a belief that great software could be made in secret behind closed doors, has decided to reconsider that proposition with respect to the most important software asset that it possesses. There is not a culture business on earth which is unaware of the competition in which its distribution arm now finds itself with freedom as its most dire competitor.
On the western winds, travel towards eastern sands, far above earth they go, a pledge for creation's soul. Move away from your western winds, travel towards eastern sands, far above earth they go, a pledge for creation's soul.
What differentiates us from those who have struggled in the past, as Volker just identified for you, is a change from utopianism to practicality. From the moment at which that movement for freedom of thought and economic or at least political equality began to gain momentum in the middle of the 18th century, those struggling for freedom were condemned to utopianism. The ideals of the American and French revolutions, which brought what there was of freedom of thought and equality of persons into being at the end of the 18th century, necessarily rested upon hopes, upon dreams and beliefs about what might be possible under conditions of tumultuous and unprecedented transformation. The Constitution of the United States, as one of its greatest interpreters has pointed out, is an experiment. To Justice Holmes and to all those lawyers and judges who over 200 years struggled to turn that experiment into practical reality, much is due. But we must also recognize, as photographs from Iraq have shown this year, that it remains in substantial part a dream subject to political disruption by those operating under the control of power. Utopianism has also the heavy drawback that the struggle to perfect a world never before experienced often turns violent, as dreams confront unexpected realities, and the dreamer has little choice but to lash out against the tyranny of fact. And so the struggle for freedom of thought and the struggle for economic equality has been substantially limited in prior generations by the inevitable reliance upon a dream of a perfect future never experienced before. And it is not insignificant that in all the European languages, the phrase, the word used to designate that perfection, utopia, means nowhere. For it is, after all, a struggle to achieve what has never been achieved. A struggle to bring about conditions that would allow human beings to be what they have never been. New socialist man, the perfect citizen of the perfect republic. These were noble dreams, and the struggle to achieve them, even at its worst, has a nobility to which we aspire. But we are fortunate, because ours is a movement built not on dreams, but on actualities. Ours is an ideology of change which depends not on what might be, but on what already is. Practical revolution, the friends and colleagues with whom I have been working for the past 20 years have shown, practical revolution is based upon two things: proof of concept and running code. That is to say, do it first and allow the implications of what has been done to settle in. Technology, unlike the Hegelian or Marxian flow of history, technology itself is irreversible. That which we have is ours, not a dream. It belongs to us. It runs. We use it. Having brought into being the tools of our liberation, it is now our privilege to use them to change the world around us. This is our special role in the long history of the struggle for freedom of thought.
One of these days, things ain't gonna change. One of these days, things ain't gonna change. Time now, baby. After a while, gonna do mine, gonna be mine. One of these days, baby, a morning droning, baby. Try, try, won't be long, long. Thing gonna change. In the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Things gonna change, things gonna change, 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 change. Things gonna change. Further on up the road, baby.
In the same way that Western science depended in the 16th century on the movement for freedom of thought, what more noble proposition could we take for our movement than the simple words, "E pur si muove," with which Galileo pointed to the intrinsic relationship between freedom of thought and scientific progress? In the same way that the scientific revolution in the West first depended upon free information exchange, so now. In the next generation, we will confront once again the recognition that without a movement for freedom of thought, science is tied to ownership. Does anybody who inspects the current pharmaceuticals industry or the forthcoming genetic revolution doubt me? Without the free exchange of ideas, science is the servant of inequality. And it is science, the ability to know, the ability to teach, the opportunity to learn everything that any human mind can reason out, it is science which is still at the root of the development of our societies. So the movement for free spectrum, like the movement for unlicensed printing, is a movement to put beneath science the power of all the available human minds. Like the war against censorship in Western Europe, the war for free spectrum is a war for the freedom of ideas in its most valuable sense. The ideas that change society, extend life, make human existence better. We have grown so accustomed to the idea that the power to communicate with one another is something we have to buy from someone else that we are in danger of forgetting just how much rests over the long history of human beings on the inherent virtue of untrammeled communication. So out of those parts, free software, free hardware, free culture, and free spectrum, we build a society of justice, of equality, of liberty. Not in the belief that if we somehow force the aristocrats out, later society will become perfect. Not out of a belief that there's some class needing liquidation. And then we imagine human beings can change. Not a dream about nowhere, but an attempt to move what we have within our apartments, within our workplaces, within our schools, out into the larger world, where it can begin to fulfill its perfectly legitimate, necessary, inevitable work of liberation. We have turned the freedom of ideas into an instrument of social change. We have become what all our ancestors dreamed of becoming. People who can take what is and make it the method of liberation. We have been singing it for 1,000 years. Die Gedanken sind frei, my thoughts freely flower. I think as I please, and this gives me power. No scholar can map them, no hunter can trap them, no man can deny, die Gedanken sind frei. In a network that circles the globe, built of freedom and responsible to no master, humanity will at last be able to hear itself think. This is what we have dreamed for. This is what we have built for. This is what we have designed. This is what we have coded. This is what we have licensed. This is what is out there in use already. We live amidst the tools of our own dream. And this rich, shining moment is the moment where we take them up and turn them deliberately in the struggle for freedom which we have long hoped to prevail in. This is another great moment in the long history of the search for liberation. And the difference is, this time, we win. Freedom, now. Thank you very much.
Walk the earth, then walk it right. say you gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. You gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. While you got the time, you got to fight, fight, fight for your mind.
Anybody taking life or death risks to make freedom somewhere carrying an iPhone. Because I know what that iPhone can be doing to him without our having any way to control it, stop it, help it, or even know it's going on. We need to think infrastructurally about what we mean to freedom now. And we need to learn the lessons of what we see happening around us in real time. One thing that the Egyptian situation showed us, as we probably knew after the Iranian situation, when we watched the forces of the Iranian state buy the telecommunications carriers, as we learned when the Egyptians begin to lean on Vodafone last week, we learn again why closed networks are so harmful to us. Why the ability to build a kill switch on the infrastructure by pressuring the for-profit communications carriers who must have a way of life with government in order to survive can harm our people seeking freedom using technology we understand well. Now, what can we do to help freedom under circumstances where the state has decided to try to clamp the network infrastructure? Well, we can go back to mesh networking. We've got to go back to mesh networking. We've got to understand how we can provide people using the ordinary devices already available to them or cheaply available to them to build networking that resists centralized control. Mesh networking in densely populated urban environments is capable of sustaining the kind of social action we saw in Cairo and in Alexandria this week. Even without the centralized network services providers, if people have wireless routers that mesh up, in their apartments, in their workplaces, in the places of public resort around them, they can continue to communicate despite attempts in central terms to shut them down. We need to go back to ensuring people secure end-to-end communications over those local meshes. We need to provide survivable conditions for the kinds of communications that people now depend upon outside the context of centralized networking environments that can be used to surveil, control, arrest, or shut them down. Can we do this? Sure. Are we going to do this? If we don't, then the great social promise of the free software movement, that free software can lead to free society, will begin to be broken. Force will intervene somewhere soon. And a demonstration will be offered to humanity that even with all that networking technology and all those young people seeking to build new lives for themselves, the state still wins. This must not happen.
Gotta go after the folks. New movement we see among younger people in Europe and in the United States about collective is free, free is right, sharing of information should be unrestricted, you know, and that comes into conflict with copyright, so be it.
So be it. So be it.
Gotta go after the folks.
So be it.
Gotta go after.
Gotta go after.
So be it.
Gotta go after. Gotta go after.
And we know we will never stop.
I know.
Never, never.
The most interesting issue about intellectual property and about copyright, and that is who really owns what, and what is the purpose of copyright, and what is the purpose of copyright, and what is the purpose of copyright.
I know that when my books are assigned in a college, kids take my words and do all sorts of junk with them. But I don't want to file a federal lawsuit about it. I don't want to go into a court and tell them, stop that person from using my work. We all understand in the context of text that you put the text out there, copyright protects you from somebody competing with you and selling the original book, but it ought to be free for people to use and reuse as they want. Those same norms have got to begin to be part of film and music and graphics as well.
And what is the purpose of copyright? What is the purpose of copyright? And what is the purpose of copyright? And what is the purpose of copyright?
We need to fix this. We need to fix it quickly.